You might suppose that if you film something apparently anomalous, you will satisfy yourself that it really happened when you see the film afterwards. But the opposite seemed to be the case here. I had watched two of Luis's hour-long sessions and seen him produce 30 drawings and 2 oil paintings within a few feet of where I sat. I had ruled out all the obvious possibilities for fraud or hallucination. I had been present when the film was shot, and yet, seeing it all on film was far less convincing than seeing the real thing had been. We talked to a number of professional artists and showed them a selection of Luis's work. All agreed that for a man with no art training to produce pictures of such quality in a weak red light, without looking at what he was doing, drawing upside down, doing 2 heads at once, and firing off portraits of unseen sitters one after the other sometimes in as little as 30 seconds simply could not be done. We also agreed that it had been done. A leading Brazilian artist, teacher and critic, after studying 30 of Luis's drawings, pointed out a few minor anatomical errors here and there, but stated very firmly that he did not think even a trained artist could produce work of such variety and skill under the conditions we described, which he later saw for himself. There remained one other doubt to clear up. Luis had been producing drawings for about 10 years, and somebody suggested that he might have simply memorized a set of portraits to the point where he could reproduce the same ones on demand. Accordingly, we asked to look at all the drawings he had preserved, and Luis obligingly produced a number of thick folders containing over 1,000 examples of his work. Many more had been given away, but none had ever been sold. No 2 pictures were identical, though many could be grouped into categories that strongly recalled the work of a dozen masters from Rembrandt and Hals de Manet, Degas, Renoir and Modigliani. There were ornately dressed laughing cavaliers, more somber faces of elderly Jews, elegant Parisienne, shapely ballerinas, voluptuous-looking models and a host of others, many unsigned. Here indeed was the Rosemary Brown of the art world. London housewife Rosemary Brown has baffled critics for several years by producing a stream of piano pieces in the style of several dead composers, especially Liszt. She has had little musical training, yet she has somehow written down music that is recognizably in the style of the composer who purports to have dictated it from the spirit world. British, living, composer Humphrey Searle, a recognized authority on Liszt, has said that one of her pieces, Grauen Quartabulae, is the kind of music Liszt might have written had he lived a few years longer, and that it is not a paraphrase of anything he is known to have written while alive. Mrs. Brown's pieces contain faults, according to Vernon Harrison, a founder member of the Liszt Society, but they are too good to dismiss lightly. 1. So it is with Luis Gasparetto. His drawings are there for all to see, and he is convinced that they are the work of the spirits of the artists concerned. Luis is an intelligent, well-educated young man from a comfortable middle-class family. He has never sought publicity, nor objected to being studied by researchers. He spends much of his time working without pay at a school for retarded children, and he does intend eventually to sell his drawings to raise money for a new spiritist center. I am sure we shall hear more of him. Next, let me introduce you to the lady from Pompeii. Celia, as I shall call her here, is an attractive and vivacious lady of about 50, though she looks 15 years younger. Her husband Leo is a very successful construction engineer, and their daughter has married into one of Brazil's grand old families. I have known them well for more than 3 years, and spent many hours listening to Celia's accounts of her extraordinary life, or I should say lives. From a very early age, it was clear that she was not like the other little girls in the small town where she was born into a wealthy and traditional Catholic family of pure Brazilian lineage. As her mother, family servant and Celia herself readily agreed, she was a little terror. By the time she was 6 years old, she had developed 2 great passions, dancing and boys. Rather than play with her many expensive toys, she would be out in the streets with the gang, inventing contests in which the winner had to kiss her on the mouth. She would go out of her way to play off one little boyfriend against another, and one of her early triumphs was a knife fight provoked in her honor. She loved every minute of it. At the age of 8, she saw a man shot dead in front of her. She calmly gave her parents the details over dinner, putting them off their appetites while she munched a bloody underdone steak without a qualm. On another occasion, she watched impassively as a man was lynched to death with iron crowbars. Such callousness in the face of death is most untypical in Brazilian women. Once, Celia was driving me across São Paulo when we passed the scene of a gruesome road accident in which a motorcycle had been flattened by a large truck. Celia drove by without a single comment. The incident meant no more to her than a hole in the road. Almost as soon as she was able to walk, she began to dance. Most girls at that age like dancing, but Celia really took it seriously. When her parents went out for the evening, she would make up her pugnacious little face at her mother's dressing table, drape any piece of cloth available around her skinny body, put a record on the gramophone and simply take over the whole house, dancing wildly all over the place. One night her parents brought some friends home, to find Celia swirling sensuously around the living room stark naked. They watched in amazement. Who taught her to move her body like that? One asked. But nobody had taught her anything. Behaving like a Spanish gypsy seemed to come naturally to her. After lunch, she would reluctantly have to lie down in her room and rest. Yet instead of sleeping, she would often lie and stare at the white ceiling, where she would see scenes of startling eroticism. Men and women were taking part in Roman-style orgies, drinking, lying around and making love to each other, and Celia felt she was part of the action as well. One of her older boyfriends had told her, when she was 6, all the details of how men and women made love, and she had listened without interest. She already knew. She had her first clear memory of another lifetime at the age of 5, as she sat on the steps of the house one day and gazed into the blue sky above. Suddenly she seemed to be somewhere else, under another blue sky, and the thought of it gave her a sudden feeling of melancholy and nostalgia. Nostalgia for what? She could not yet say. From then on, throughout her life, Celia has had a series of recurrent dreams, some of which still come 2 or 3 times a year. 3 of them are especially vivid, and it has often taken her all day to recover from the effects of them. In the first, she is in a boat approaching an island, not a typical Brazilian one with sandy beaches and palm trees, but a bare slab of rock lashed by violent seas. She feels she is being taken there for some specific reason, and can see flaming torches dotted around the island. The second recurrent dream takes place in a dark room that seems like a sort of corridor made of blocks of stone. Various men are lounging about on benches, flirting with a young girl whom Celia knows to be herself. Through a window she can see people walking about with baskets on their heads, coming back from market. Everybody is wearing tunics. At the end of the dream, she walks down a passage on the way out of what seems to be a bathhouse, and meets a sallow-faced old man who blocks her way. She feels a great desire to excite him sexually, and kisses him on the mouth, but is horrified to find his lips are stone cold. "You can't do me any more harm," the man says, "because I have been dead for 2,000 years. The third dream is by far the most vivid and frightening. Celia is at the window of her house, looking over the rooftops at a distant mountain. Suddenly she gets a feeling of terror, runs out of the house, along a street, through an archway and onto a beach. Then she rushes headlong into the sea and is drowned. In addition to these 3 recurrent dreams, Celia has had a number of once-only ones that she has remembered in great detail. In one, she is dancing around a campfire and doing her best to provoke a man who eventually takes her by the waist, forces her to the ground and kills her. In another, somebody is singing a Spanish gypsy song to guitar accompaniment, while she plays a game where she has to eat a whole plate of grapes before the music stops. In another, she is simply eating a meal in a poor-looking brick house, picking up pieces of sausage with her fingers and dipping them in salt. In all these dreams, she is aware that she is a member of a tribe of Spanish gypsies, and one of its star dancers. When Celia heard the sound of castanets for the first time, She became so excited that she followed the sound to a ballet school near her house, where she marched in and immediately started to learn Spanish dancing. Or, more accurately, she just started to do it, for she seemed to know it all and there was little her teacher could tell her. She took to the castanets like a duck to water and became the best dancer in the school. Spanish dancing is not widely popular in Brazil, where the majority of the people are of Portuguese stock and Spanish immigrants have tended to abandon their native customs. Even traditional Portuguese folk music is rarely heard, and Spanish music almost never. Yet to Celia, flamenco dancing was the most natural thing in the world, and soon she was to become quite well known for a time as a Spanish dancer on television, convincing many of her partners that she came from Spain, although she had never been there. At least, not in this lifetime. Girls tend to be strictly brought up in Brazil, especially in Catholic families from small towns in the interior. But Celia refused to conform to any conventions. As a child, she would peel off her clothes and jump naked into the swimming pool regardless of who might be watching. She would drink wine and beer without feeling this was in any way unusual. Early in her teens, she would go all out not only to attract men but to sleep with them, and by the time she was an adult, she was something of a nymphomaniac. Moving to the city of São Paulo, she soon met her future husband Leo, and married him when she was 24. Leo was engaged already, but Celia simply set out to push the other woman out of the way and get her man. They became a couple of young swingers, living it up all night in bars and clubs and making love to each other, which they still do at least twice a week, on all possible occasions. Eventually they had to reinforce their sex lives with pornographic films and books, of which Celia bought and read large quantities although she has scarcely ever read any other kind of book. They even indulged in sex a tour de toit, with the help of a lady friend brought in to liven up their nightlife. After some years of this sort of behavior, odd things began to happen. Doors would slam loudly in the night, lights would turn on and off, and inexplicable noises of all kinds would be heard when there was nobody else in the house. On the advice of a close friend familiar with poltergeist phenomena, who told them that such things often happened to people who led sexually depraved lives, they decided to change their way of living and behave more normally. Then both of them learned to their surprise that they were what are known as mediums. They went along to the São Paulo Spiritist Federation to study this strange phenomenon, and Leo soon found he had an unusual ability to transfer energy to other people through what are called mediumistic passes. Neither of them was ever what could be called the religious type, as they are not today. But in retrospect both feel that they were literally saved by their spiritist friends from a life of total depravity and uselessness. In 1970, Celia went abroad for the first time in her life, on a grand tour of Europe with her daughter and three close friends. They saw all the usual tourist sights, none of which made much impression on Celia. But when they took a boat to the island of Ischia, off the Italian coast, she had one of the most profound shocks of her life. There was her rock, the one she had been dreaming about for 40 years. It was exactly the shape it had been in her dreams, although it was now dotted with luxury villas instead of flaming torches. She had unquestionably been there before. Then the party went to visit the ruined Roman city of Pompeii, near the volcanic Mount Vesuvius that had showered it with flaming lava in the year 79 AD. As soon as she set foot in the place, Celia led her friends on a guided tour of the well-preserved ruins, pointing out her bathhouse, her amphitheater, and finally her house. To everybody's alarm, except Celia's, they learned from the real tourist guide that this had been the local brothel and was not open to visitors. The following year, Celia came back to Pompeii with Leo and they spent more time there. She was furious to find that her house was still locked up, and only after much persuasion and bribery were they able to get inside. Celia had already described the place in detail to her husband. Upstairs there were a number of small rooms, each decorated with friezes of pornographic scenes, showing naked men and women doing things that may be new even to students of the Kama Sutra of Vatsyayana. And from the small window in her room, there was a perfectly framed view of Mount Vesuvius. They went into the building, and there it all was, exactly as Celia had so often seen and described it. The friezes were still there, and Vesuvius was still where it always had been, neatly framed in the window of her room. In great excitement, Celia led her husband out of the whorehouse and showed him the route she had taken on the day the mountain had erupted. She led him along her street, the Via dell'Abbondanza, under the arch and outside the city limits. Here, something was wrong. There was no sea in sight. The coastline was more than a mile away, and a group of archaeologists was digging in the ground near the spot where Celia recalled making her fatal dash into the waves. They went over to talk to the archaeologists, asking if they knew by any chance where the shoreline had been at the time of the destruction of Pompeii. "Right here, Signora," they replied. Celia had hardly heard of Pompeii in her present life. As a child she had scarcely read any foreign history, and her film going had been restricted to the regular local fare of Tom Mix and Rin Tin Tin. There was no television in Brazil in those days. She had in fact always thought that her dreams were of ancient Egypt rather than Pompeii, but after her two visits to the ruined Roman seaside resort, a flood of detailed memories came back to her, and in 1973 she recorded 16 hours of these memories on tape. I wondered if she had ever read Bulwer Lytton's Last Days of Pompeii. She had, she told me, recently picked up a copy, but had given it up halfway through. It wasn't like that at all, she commented. Women, she assured me, were not the meek and passive creatures depicted in Bulwer Lytton's book. We used to run everything in those days. So it does not seem likely that her memories of Pompeii were based on anything she had read. On their way back to Brazil, after Leo had had some difficulty in dragging his wife away from Pompeii, the couple stopped off in Spain. Having identified the site of one past life, Celia was determined to locate another. She never managed to discover a particular place she recognized as easily as Pompeii or Ischia, but she felt quite at home in the dry countryside around Granada, and was flattered when a shop assistant refused to believe she was a Brazilian. Pace mas unuas poetilda plus minus a larqueo. The woman said. You look more Spanish than I do. On several other occasions she would be greeted by Spaniards with the question, but aren't you a Mora, gypsy? As far as she was concerned, of course she was. Or had been. Readers may have concluded by now that Celia is no more than a hysterical, suggestible and altogether nutty member of the wealthy class, who has nothing better to do than dream. This would be totally wrong. It is not possible to feel that way if you knew her. She is certainly not a typical Brazilian. Women of her age and social status tend to be very class conscious, and to do all they can to preserve, or at least simulate, an appearance of respectability and culture. Celia, however, could not care less about social conventions. Her high society friends regard her as a colorful eccentric, vivacious and uninhibited but never vulgar or crude. They are impressed by her fearless character. Once, she spotted a suspicious-looking prowler outside her house, and rather than call the police or her husband, she took her own revolver, stuck it in the astonished man's back and marched him over a mile to the nearest police station. Brazilian women do not normally do such things. There is no ready explanation as to how the daughter of a rich and respectable family, her father was a senior government official, should grow into a reincarnation of a Spanish gypsy or a trollop from Pompeii, which Celia freely admits she was, in great detail. Hers is the kind of experience that seems to cross the border from the merely abnormal into the totally paranormal. She accepts reincarnation as a matter of course, though she has not the slightest interest in the religious or metaphysical aspects of this much debated subject. As far as she is concerned, her present life is merely one stage in the long personal process of evolution through trial, error and experience. She is aware of the fact that in this lifetime she has been happily married for the first time, to a man she has known several times before. Her daughter does not resemble her in the least, She is a quiet and well-balanced young woman whose presence in the family home seems to bring her lively extrovert parents together and calm them down. Celio is a very practical person, an efficient organizer of social and charitable functions, and the most popular teacher at the ballet school where she gives lessons in Spanish dancing. She has little interest in the paranormal as such, though she accepts the basic principles of spiritism. She takes a realistic attitude towards her own experience, feeling that she was born this time round into a family that gave her a chance to improve on her licentious former lives, although this took some time, to make an excellent marriage and raise a daughter whose virtues are as noticeable as her own shortcomings, to do some useful social work and generally become more aware of the purpose of life, death and rebirth. Was she really recalling one or more past lives? If her dream memories were unique, I could dismiss them as one-off fantasies possibly constructed by her subconscious mind. Yet, as I was soon to discover, they were far from unique. Hers was just one of the 71 cases in the IBPP files of what have become known as cases suggestive of reincarnation. Here follows a selection from the other 70. 3. Born again. Silvia was born in a São Paulo hospital at 9 in the morning on March 20, 1963. She was her mother's first child, and she spent the first day of her life in an incubator, for she had been born a blue baby a few weeks premature. Her grandmother, a trained nurse and obstetrician, looked after her while her mother recovered from her ordeal, and it was grandma who picked up the day-old Silvia and greeted her with the word Simamayo. She did not know at the time, nor has she known since, why she used the Italian words for my love instead of the Portuguese Mamor. Silvia, however, smiled happily as if she understood. When she was less than a month old, a large aeroplane flew over the house while Grandma was giving her the bottle. Silvia stopped sucking the rubber teat and looked at her grandmother in apparent terror. "Don't be afraid, Amamayo," Grandma soothed her. "It's nothing. Just a plane going by. You can drink your milk." Again, she had no idea why she used the Italian phrase like Silvia's parents. She was Brazilian-born, and the only Italian ancestor in the family was the baby's maternal grandfather, who had died in 1954. Although São Paulo has welcomed millions of immigrants from Italy since late in the 19th century, the Italian language is practically never heard there, for Italians find little difficulty in learning Portuguese. Yet before little blue-eyed Silvia was 2 years old, she had shown another peculiarity in addition to her inexplicable fear of aeroplanes, a fluent knowledge of Italian. When her first sister was born, Silvia greeted her as Mia Soila, not Mnu Irma. Her mother was Momina rather than the Portuguese Mommy. She would ask for her bambola instead of her bonka, or doll. One day on being woken up by Momina she announced that she was feliz, a word with one more syllable than the Portuguese for happy, feliz. Her mother repeated this to the washerwoman that afternoon. "But nobody here speaks Italian," the woman replied, amused. "Io parlo," Silvio interrupted at once. She was a talkative child, whatever her favorite language, and was quite fluent in normal Portuguese by the age of 2 despite her surprising Italian vocabulary. One day she was babbling away merrily to her mother, who was not paying much attention to what she was saying, until she suddenly turned and said, "Apostrophe dot the, on the capital A-O, isn't it, Momina?" "What's that?" her mother asked. All it suggested to her at the time was the Capitol building in Washington. "It's a Monty, of course," Silvia replied, and subsequent reference to the dictionary showed that it was indeed the name of one of the 7 hills on which Rome was built, as well as that of the Temple of Jupiter that stood there. Before she was 3, Silvia came out with more unexpected words for a Brazilian-born girl of immediate Brazilian descent. When her mother sent her on an errand with her grandfather she exclaimed "Andamo," an expression quite unlike the Portuguese "vamos," or "let's go." When she was playing with a ball of wool and getting it all tied in knots, she handed it to Grandma and said, "Here, it's all spuncagliato." This is how Grandma recorded the word at the time. It may have been an attempt at spuncagliato, literally, scattered. Once, Sylvia climbed into a pair of her mother's shoes and started clattering round the house. When Grandma told her to be quiet, she replied, "Don't disturb me, I'm doing a pesta dura." This means nothing in Portuguese, but in Italian it is literally hard foot or stamping, which is indeed what she was doing. Seeing her youngest sister lying in her pram, Sylvia commented on the fact that she was losca, or cross-eyed, the Portuguese for which is vesgo. Grandma noted all these words in a special diary she had kept since the day of Sylvia's birth. This was to prove of great value when IBPP researchers eventually began to study the case. For Sylvia's third birthday, Grandma gave her an Italian dictionary with a specially written dedication listing 14 words in Italian she had spoken up to then. "I do not know what connection we had before in another incarnation," Grandma wrote on the flyleaf of the dictionary. "I only know that I loved you very much, as I love you now, and that we have met again, Amamayo." Sylvia's family were all spiritists, and accepted reincarnation as a perfectly normal event, which explains why they never scolded her for talking nonsense, as many parents would have done when she began to come out with apparent memories of another life, and words in a foreign language. They knew that by the age of 8 or 9 such memories would have faded, and Sylvia would be a perfectly adjusted and happy little Brazilian girl, provided they looked after her properly. The first sign of what some researchers now like to call extracerebral memory came one day when Grandma was walking Sylvia around the block. "Grandma, do you want me to tell you about my friend?" Sylvia asked. "There were 2 bad boys who tried to take my friend's money away, and she went after them and she hit them." "You liked your friend a lot, didn't you?" Grandma commented. "Do you miss her?" Sylvia lowered her head, and when she raised it again, Grandma saw tears running down her cheeks. Gradually, other scraps of information about Sylvia's previous life in Rome came out, usually one at a time and in brief fragments. Although both her mother and grandmother later recalled that she was always a talkative child, and much of what she said was soon forgotten. They clearly remember many references to Sylvia's special friend, and one day she came out with the name Afonso Denari, whose husband was called Gennaro and who used to look after Sylvia and her other friends. They all seemed to live on or in the capital, though Sylvia never made it clear whether she meant the hill or the temple. Gennaro would bring them rice to eat, and sometimes they had macaroni with wine. The house where they lived was all broken and there was no roof on the kitchen. She remembered what had happened to some of her friends. Tito was hurt in the leg and had to be treated by a doctor from what Sylvia called the United States. Then Tito went away to a hole full of earth, and they threw more earth on top of her and she never came back. Cecilia, pronounced in the Italian manner, was very naughty and kept running away, and Sylvia would have to go after her. One day another girl went to sleep in a closed wooden cradle and never woke up. Then there were the bombs. One day a few months after her third birthday, Sylvia was playing in the garden when an aeroplane roared overhead. As usual, Sylvia showed signs of fear. When this happened while she was inside the house, she would ask her mother to shut the door to keep it out. Grandma assured her that this was just a nice plane carrying people around, and it was nothing like the ones she had seen from the capital. "That's right," Sylvia replied. "There in the capital the planes would drop bombs this big. And then there were a lot of pieces of metal on the ground that hurt people." On one occasion she gave a description of a bomb as looking like a pen you write with, and bombs resembling fountain pens were known to have been dropped on Rome after the Allied occupation. In January 1967, Sylvia caught sight of a new calendar hanging on the wall, a present from a local tradesman, and pointed excitedly to the color photograph of Rome. "There it is," she cried. "That's the capital. That's the house I used to live in, and that's the school, and those are the rocks I used to jump about on." The only caption under the picture read Rome, Italy, but the scene did indeed show the Temple of Jupiter, some buildings in the background, and several stumps of columns in the foreground. The word capital did not appear anywhere on the calendar, and Sylvia was the only one who recognized the scene. "I don't want to go back to the capital," she said later. Now I was born here and I only want this mother, this is the one I want. It was on Easter Sunday in April 1966, when Sylvia was 3 years and 1 month old, that she came out with her most startling memory. Her grandfather was in the kitchen preparing lunch, when an aeroplane went overhead, producing the usual reaction of alarm on Sylvia's normally happy face.